55 years ago, the first Ohio Valley Jazz Festival was held in Cincinnati. My guest tonight is Scott Santangelo, who has just written a new book, The Ohio Valley Jazz Fest, for Arcadia Books. Scott is the son of the legendary promoter Dino Santangelo. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a great little book. It brought back a lot of memories. I'm actually old enough that I went to the Jazz Fest at Crosley Field. How did you start helping with Dad? And tell me a little bit about how it began for you.
Well, I was born in 1960, so this was something I grew up with, and we had the opportunity to attend a lot of shows. Well, my father was the promoter of record in our city for many, many years, and he did many other things besides the jazz festival. So from the Albee to the Palace, had the opportunity to work in a lot of the old theaters in town.
And he even did some work for Beverly Hills, too, or entertainers who played there?
Yep. In his earliest days, he got into the business while he was still in the University of Cincinnati and responded to an ad for a PR person for the Sheraton Gibson Hotel, which is where the Westin is basically today. And the Beverly Hills was one of their clients.
So it was through the Sheraton that the Jazz Festival connection started over in French Lick after the Sheraton bought it, correct?
That's right. They acquired a resort in French Lick, Indiana. And my father was a jazz enthusiast. And they conceived of an idea to bring what was then the festival, the Jazz Festival from Newport, George Wein's event, to the Midwest. And that's how it all began.
Was there just one year in French Lick?
It was a wildly successful year, 58 in French Lick. It was so successful that it was canceled the following year. The town was too small to handle an event like that, and it was really a constellation of stars for that show.
And then it ended up in 62 in Cincinnati at the Carthage Fairgrounds, correct?
That's right. That was officially the first Ohio Valley Jazz Festival.
And the lineup that you have in there is just amazing. Louis Armstrong, Brubeck, Ellington, Jerry Mulligan, Sonny Rollins, Horace Silver, Coleman Hawkins. Just an amazing lineup.
Yeah, I have to look those up and remind myself. Again, I was 2 years old at that time. So looking back, it's almost hard to imagine all of these acts on one show. But the early years were just like that. And those must have been amazing concerts to attend.
And then 2 years at Carthage, and then it moved to Crosley Field.
That's right, in 1964.
And there's some beautiful color pictures. I'm going to guess 68, 69, one of the last years you did it at Crosley before Riverfront opened, in color, showing the stage kind of down the right field line against the first base side.
I was so lucky because in part, most of the images in the book are drawn from the files of the festival itself, which I've been carrying around for decades. So this is a real tribute to my dad, and fortunately I had a lot of these images. But there were notable exceptions, and that was one of them. And I just by chance saw an image on eBay. I contacted the seller, who turned out to have been the guy who did the sound that year, who was also the partner of the guy who did the sound at Woodstock. And he said, oh, you know what? I think I have a couple rolls of film that I took at that year, and let me dig them out and see if I can find them for you. His name was Bob Bennett. So he very graciously provided those. And to look at those early years, you have to laugh at the level of the production.
And then, of course, it moved to Riverfront in 70, and this book goes
71.
Through 71. And then it goes through what would have been your father's last concert, what, 85, 86?
86. He passed away at 52. It was the silver anniversary of the festival. And that was, I think, the year before Cool Cigarettes withdrew its sponsorship. So really, it was the end of an era.
So I've seen these books all over the place, the Arcadia book or the Images of Modern America. So how did this book come about?
Well, I've always meant to do this. And as I hit my mid-50s, it was one of those things I wanted to accomplish for my own kids and one day for their kids, to tell that story and to remind Cincinnati about the contributions of Dino Santangelo. A lot of people don't remember those early years and those early shows and the many other events he promoted, produced, and was involved in. And having carried around the files from those early festivals, as I went through them, I'd find original contracts signed by Duke Ellington and or Louis Armstrong, photos and tickets and backstage passes and correspondence. And it was really a story I felt that not only I wanted to tell for my own selfish reasons, but that I thought really was a tribute and a testament to Cincinnati in many ways. Because who would have imagined a festival like this would have come to a Midwestern city like Cincinnati.
I want to ask you more on that point, but I want to go step back because actually the first image is Fountain Square, and it's really kind of a family history. When the family first came over, what, 1913, was that?
Yeah, the story wouldn't be complete without a little bit of backstory. My grandfather was an immigrant tailor, came over as a little boy through Ellis Island. So really, it's a wonderful American success story. Of course, all the other children from my father's family were also very successful in their careers, and my uncle today carries on the tradition with the festival here in Cincinnati. So when you look across that panorama of history, I think it adds something to the festival story.
You had mentioned it struck me, too, that Cincinnati might have been kind of an unusual place. We get Newport Jazz Festival, why it sprang up here, and the social implications of having this as a jazz mecca.
Well, aside from the fact that Cincinnati in the Midwest was very receptive to jazz music in the late 50s, early 60s. So I'll start there. And my father was quite an enthusiast. He was a musician in his own right. He played trumpet. He was a band leader in college and in high school. But the festival in those early years would never have come to Cincinnati if it had not been for him, his vision, and his enthusiasm. Because I think George Wein at the time had suffered some reverses in Newport and was, I think, struggling at that moment. And the opportunity to bring the Newport Festival first to French Lick, but then later to Cincinnati was more than a leap of faith for George. So I think he relied on the enthusiasm and optimism of my father to find the investors and to persuade the city fathers and to find the appropriate venue at which this event could be held in Cincinnati.
But there was also a social impact, was there not, in terms of integration, in terms of accommodating these great jazz musicians who were African-American in Cincinnati in the early 60s?
Well, absolutely. And I think that's a happy confluence of circumstances because Cincinnati has always been a leader in the arts for its size. I now work at Music Hall, and I'd love to brag about our symphony. Sixth oldest symphony in the country, second oldest opera in the country, longest running choral festival in the Western Hemisphere. We have so much to be proud of. But this is a chapter that not many people remember to be proud of. And I think that was another goal I had in writing the book.
So when it moved to Riverfront Stadium, the kind of the artist lineup changed a little bit. It changed to kind of more rhythm and blues with Lou Rawls, B.B. King, Roberta Flack.
The shows caught on. The festival continued to grow, and sponsors began to drive the programming. And as the attendance continued to exceed the capacities of the venues at which it was being held, they continued to search for larger and larger venues. So the Ohio Valley Jazz Festival enjoyed being the first non-sporting event in the new Riverfront Stadium, which in and of itself was a remarkable step for a conservative market like Cincinnati to permit an event like that to be held in such a prestigious community venue. But again, I think it's a testament to the city and the people who were running the city at the time to allow that to go forward. And I think over the years, their wisdom was proven.
Actually, a rock concert wasn't held in Riverfront till the late 70s, I believe, after Springer was mayor.
I think it's uncontestable. If you were to ask the police officers then or now which type of an event they would prefer to work, which one is the least problematic, they would unanimously say the jazz festival, far and away, is a better event for us to work.
So you were too young to go to the Crosley ones, but going to the Riverfront ones, working for your dad's company, do you have some favorite artists, some favorite times?
You know, it's funny because when you grow up in that business, in that industry, we were always working the events. We didn't sit down and watch the shows, or I wasn't an aficionado of any of the artists per se. But certainly, as you hear B.B. King perform live and the audience is reacting, and it's an inescapable magic when you're in a setting like that. So, yeah, we were very close to the events and worked all the aspects of them. But in a way, I wasn't a fan at the time. I've grown to be a much bigger fan.
And even in your current job as director of operations for Music Hall for the Cincinnati Arts Association, some people might think you've got front row seats, you're there for every show, but your job is in the back office to make sure that there's tickets sold and the artist shows up on time and got somebody booked for the next week and a lot of other stuff.
I would never imagine of sitting in the front row for any of our clients' events. And you're right, when you work in facility operations, your focus is much more on the patron's experience, the patron's enjoyment, and making certain that the table is set for those events. And when you work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and you have a large staff, concessions, custodial, engineering, technical, again, that's not where your head's at, you know, on a daily basis. Though I won't deny it's a wonderful place. Even to hear the opera performers rehearsing in the dressing rooms on a business day is a real treat.
I'm going to get back to the book a second. Do you got a favorite picture in here?
There are a lot of fantastic images, and most of these have never been seen by the public before, which I think was really one of my goals, is to get these out into the public domain and share them. I think it's more the stories than the photos, though, of course, the photos are worth 1,000 words each. So I think my favorite stories or my favorite photos are when my dad was in Europe touring with Miles Davis. And so favorite photo is on page 23. It's a picture of Hosea Williams, the nationally known civil rights leader who was in the Selma March. And it's a picture of J. Lee Friedman, a legendary Atlanta promoter, and my father. And Hosea Williams personalized it to my man, Dino, which to me, that picture says so much about the festivals and what they meant to people and how they bridge the disconnect, especially in those early years between the black and white communities. The other photos, of course, were Miles Davis, when my father toured through Europe as the tour manager. And Miles Davis, I've interviewed him when he performed at Music Hall many years ago. And he knew my father very well. And he said, Dino was one of the few white men that I liked. I couldn't imagine a higher praise from an artist of the caliber of Miles Davis. And that, to me, is another testament to him, his character, the type of person he was.
I also enjoyed some of the posters in here.
The
advertising.
Yep.
This is a great book. It's called The Ohio Valley Jazz Festival, Images of Modern America, an Arcadia book. I want to thank you, Scott, for coming in. I've been speaking with Scott Santangelo about his new book called The Ohio Valley Jazz Festival. You'll find a link at wvxu.org/AroundCincinnati. For Around Cincinnati, this is John Keesman.